You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we take a moment in the midst of the whirlwind to review and reflect, discussing how to stay grounded, continue engaging, and organize for the long haul in deep and powerful ways.
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Bagwanu, welcome to our show. I'm coming to you from my home in the Dawn Land along the beautiful Bunawabskik River. We've had a lot of snow here lately in the Northeast, 3 feet just the other day. But today the sun is shining and the snow is melting and there are robins in the trees. And it makes me hopeful that there are some brighter days to come. I certainly could use some brighter days in my life. And as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. Hi, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. You know, it is a time of year when in New Mexico, at least, it flip-flops back and forth from freezing cold to hot and bright and sunny. The snow melts, the snow falls, the tree looks like it's going to burst into leaves at any moment. Well, it really actually has several months more to go of freezing temperatures. But what I've been reflecting on is that's how I actually feel right now in our political and social world. My social world is just as much upheaval as our political world, which is dramatic to say the least. And that everything is really tumultuous right now. So what's on my mind today is how do we stay grounded in the midst of it all? Because it is crazy making what's going on in the world. I know my partner and I went to go see Hidden Figures, which is a story, for those who don't know, it's a movie about a true story of African-American female mathematicians working on the NASA space program in the 1960s and the racism that they dealt with. And the crazy making part of watching that movie right now is that it's a upholding of science and mathematics and integrity and honoring and respecting all people. But we're watching this movie at a time when our president and his administration are literally scrubbing the climate science data off of NASA's websites, and citizen hackers and cyber activists are working together to create backup systems for all of the climate science data in existence right now, just in case the regime tries to destroy it all. Now, that is just wacky. It's like cognitive dissonance is so high right now in our world that I know myself and many others, especially long-term activists, are both mobilizing into action as quickly as possible, but also trying to find those ways to stay grounded and stay sane, because it's happening fast and furious, but we also suspect it's not going to be over in a heartbeat, that we're going to have to do this for a while. You have any thoughts on that?
I have so many thoughts on that. I think that one of the things that has certainly been the case in my life in recent weeks is a focus on what's really important. A focus on what was it that led us to this specific place and time. Thinking a lot about the philosophy around being a warrior. What does that mean? What have we done to the ground for cultivating warriors? I just finished writing a section of my book, which is finally almost finished, on the cultivation of warriors. One of the things that I focus on in there is that we are destroying the ground that's needed to grow warriors. And I'm not talking about soldiers, and I'm not talking about the type of forceful military and police leadership that we have. I'm talking about true warriors of the soul, people who are committed to a life of service and protection of all life. you know, we haven't really been cultivating the ground for them to be grown in. And part of the problem is that we have these colonial education systems that keep us fed into these systems that are destroying us, that no longer are we creating warriors, but we're just creating soldiers who are focused on short-term conquest, missions of short-term conquest. We've talked about that on the show before, that we know how to do short-term disruption, but how do we do the work for the long haul? How do we stay focused in this time and recognize that this is going to be the work of our lives and it's going to be passed on to the next generation? We're not going to solve all these problems at once. How do we fortify ourselves? How do we hold the line? How do we do what needs to be done in order to prevent the harm that's rolling towards us from destroying our opportunity to continue to exist into the future so that we can address these problems? All of those things are in the minds of people right now, and there's a deep sense of despair and grief that people are dealing with. So there's so much going on right now that you and I talked earlier, that it's one thing after another over the last couple of weeks since the inauguration, and it's like scattershot. So, you know, how do we chase down all of these different pathways, try to prevent the harm, and also do the work that we need to be doing in order to fortify our lines, you know, because that's really what we need to be focused on. We need to be organizing. We need to be addressing all of these issues of division that have come up within our movements. And we're doing it all under fire, and everybody is exhausted. So that's what we're going to talk about today, is how do we address all of those things and still have something left at the end of the day to give to our own lives.
And, you know, just in case any listeners haven't figured this out yet, we're going to take today to do a bit of a review and reflection show because, as Sherry just mentioned, we are in a time where things are happening fast and furious. And if we don't take a pause, even for an hour, this hour of this precious radio time together, to really reflect, not just react, then we will never get to the world that we're seeking. We will only be caught in the fight to save ourselves in the world that we're stuck in. So one of the things your words brought up for me, Sherry, was the image of Thich Nhat Hanh, who is the Vietnamese monk, very famous now, but at one point he was completely obscure, immersed in the middle of the Vietnam War, speaking up for peace. While it was treason to both sides of the North and South Vietnamese conflict, seeing his fellow brothers and sisters in the Buddhist orders being tortured and killed for speaking up and working towards peace. And one of his memoirs is entitled Lotus in a Sea of Fire. For me, it's such a pertinent image, especially for those of us who understand the devastation of the Vietnam War and how literally it was like hell on earth to be living under those conditions. And so one of the things we can do is reach to teachers, reach to sources, reach to the people who inspire us, and really start to think about the stories that are both new and old, familiar and new ones to us in these times, so that we can draw lessons from them. For me, one of the things that Thich Nhat Hanh's story brings to me is the strength of compassion in the midst of utter insanity, that his commitment to holding compassion in his heart, even under those incredibly difficult circumstances, reminds me that it can be a grounding force in our lives and a way of, this is almost an antiquated reference to true ourselves, as in truing our ship to the North Star, or truing or leveling aboard so that we are in alignment with what's really important. We have something to guide us that is pretty unshakable, and that when times seem crazy, that's when compassion and love can actually serve us in the work that we're doing. When we don't know quite what is right and what is wrong, or the level of injustice seems so insane that we don't know where to plant our feet to take a stand against it. Do we get upset about Trump's most recent tweet? Do we get upset about the fact that the administration is getting poised to wreak havoc on the earth, they and us, rely on for our very existence? Where do we take a stand and what battles do we fight? And how do we actually do transformation without even necessarily using the battle metaphor, but in a whole different paradigm altogether? These are the questions I'm reflecting on right now.
I think that one of the things that we need to be able to look at and look at honestly is this whole issue of generational trauma, that we all carry these wounds from our history of violence that we share. It doesn't matter where we come from. We are carrying the wound of violence within us, this trauma that is embedded into our genetic structure. And when that trauma isn't healed, it's passed on to the next generation. And oftentimes, you talked about the Vietnam War. There have been multiple massacres on this land of indigenous people. There have been other horrific events like the Holocaust in Germany. And we have all of this trauma that was so immediate and so immense for the people who experienced it that they couldn't process it properly. And so the imprint of that trauma gets passed on to the next generation and then the next, who continue to act that trauma out in ways that are not conscious. We don't understand why we're uncomfortable in each other's presence. We just know that we are. And so when we continue to carry that trauma and continue to act it out generation after generation, it continues to feed the same cycles that led to the trauma taking place in the first place. So one of the things that's really critical about this time is us being willing to stand face to face with each other, you know, heart to heart and breath to breath, and to acknowledge that the pain that I carry within me is the same pain that you carry, no matter who your ancestors were or where you come from, that we're all carriers of that pain. And I think it's really critical for us to address that, to acknowledge that common wounding that we all share so that we can begin the process of healing it. We're going to be having a healing ceremony for that very thing that's open to people from all over the world in July, July 14th through 16th here. We can post something about that on the page. But being able to address that, to stop the transmission of that trauma, is going to be critical for the path that we are able to create going forward. Because one of the things that challenges us is that we're not conscious of the origination point of that pain, but it's reactive to all of the new pain that we experience. And we're experiencing a great deal of pain right now. All of those people who see the implications and the immediate impacts of this destruction on our planet. The people in Flint, Michigan are certainly aware of it, where all of their children have been poisoned. They still don't have clean drinking water in Flint, Michigan. The people at Standing Rock are certainly aware of it. People all over the country who are dealing with the catastrophe of environmental destruction that's being caused by the fossil fuel industry across the board are certainly aware of it. They're suffering the health implications of it, the disruptions to their livelihood. We have, you know, a city in the U.S. that has not had clean drinking water for a very, very long time. We can't solve that problem. How are we going to solve these other problems that are mounting and massing upon us? We need to be able to deal with the pain that that causes within us, but we haven't been trained to feel our pain. We've been trained to avoid it, never to look too closely at it, you know, that if it starts creeping out, we're quick to subdue it. And so the courage to feel pain is something that we've never been taught. And so we don't know how to respond to it. We don't know how to sit with it. We don't know how to deal with it in a way that can help to ease it. And until we're able to do that, that pain is going to continue stalking us. We're never going to be able to rest because everywhere that we go and however fast we move, it's going to be with us. And so I think that that piece, getting to the core issues, looking at the fact that this country was founded in blood and the reality of the wounding that is present within the people who live here upon that land, that carries the wound. The people carry the wound. The land carries the wound. The spiritual imprint that overlays this land carries that wound. We have to heal that so that we can create something new. We have to be looking at all of these other issues that are connected to that original wounding, that are just a continued outcropping of that. All of these patterns that we continue to see, the genocide, the removal, the termination of Indigenous peoples and Indigenous rights continues on to this day in this land. Slavery is alive and well, continues on in multiple forms in this land. You know, there are so many things that are echoes of that past wounding that are still taking place. But if we want to be able to start addressing the contemporary issues that we are dealing with, we have to stop for a minute and catch our breath and acknowledge that wound so that we can start looking at all of the ways that it's spun out. And in the meantime, we have to engage Samognus, which is the warrior practice of holding back the tide of harm. And that's a lot to ask, but it's absolutely required at this particular point in time, because we're at this nexus point where all of these things are colliding and our survival is what's at stake.
Those are all such powerful points, Sherry, and I'm so glad you brought up Smogness at the end of that, because what I was really thinking about was that image exactly. And then some of the tools of doing that work that, you know, our kind of westernized, colonized perspective has taught us that anger and outrage, which are both real human emotions and completely justifiable in this moment, but our kind of colonized perspective on that is that those are the only tools we have to get the work done of protection and justice. But in reality, all of our emotions are tools to that effect. The sorrow that we feel, the real fear that we feel, the humanness, the honesty, the uncertainty, the love for our children, for the land, for the water, the reality of being human in all of its dimensions is a toolbox of emotional strengths that we have at our disposal for doing this transformational and healing work. And that's a really important distinction at this time, that if we keep believing in the mythologies of conquest and violence, then we're going to end up in the same predicament over and over and over again. And if we can take, as you said, a moment to step back and reflect, then we may find ourselves looking at several different paths forward, which we can make choices about taking. And so, you know, it's hard to think about this in terms of the most public figures in the equation. For instance, it's very hard for me to think about the Trump administration and all of its various appointees and advisors from this place of transformation and love. I will confess to having some difficulty there. But when I think about certain Trump supporters, people who voted for him, who were hoping for a change and finding out that they're not getting the change that they had expected, that's where I feel like there's a little bit of elbow room. Do we agree on all issues? Absolutely not. But is there a place of seeing the possibility of the transformational aspect of what needs to happen, both for myself and for the other side of the aisle? I can see the possibility within that. But for that work to take place, we also have to engage everything we know about the holding actions, as Joanna Macy might describe it, or as you describe it, Sherry, with the ability to hold back the worst of the destruction so that we have room and space for the healing, the transformation, the honest conversations, the dialogues, the doing of democracy, of community self-governance, all of that stuff. And so for me, this is a time of also mobilization, of really looking at the scope of the problems with starkness and clarity. And that takes practice as well. It takes strength as well, because we also are not trained to look at the problems. If we have the luxury of privilege to avoid looking at the scope of injustice, we tend to do it to whatever degree that we are able. And so one of the practices that's before us right now is to learn how to not look away, but then also grow our capacity to not look away so we don't make ourselves insane or so deeply sunk in depression that we cannot actually function. So I think there is a lot of work on every level that we're doing, but the one hopeful part I see is that I am seeing more and more people moving towards doing the actual work that needs to be done. I see a lot of moderates saying, where were you all under Obama? Why didn't you take care of this? Some of this was problems then, too. And that's a very valid point. But the other side of that is, okay, we are here now, and what are we going to do about it? How are we going to meet these challenges? If we have all the motivations now, let us use this opportunity to our best advantage and make some tremendous strides wherever possible to do the changes that we actually have known for quite some time must be done. We know we need to address racism. We know we need to address inequality. We know we have to stop the use of fossil fuels, both in terms of the infrastructure and also in terms of our personal use. We know this will take individual action, but it will also take collective action. And we know that collective action can both be empowering in terms of movements and incredibly frustrating in terms of the current political systems and structures, which are designed to be disempowering to the majority of people, so a small minority can actually become quite powerful and profit from that power. So the work is before us, and the hopeful part is that people are stepping up, and the challenging part that I see is that on the other side of the equations, there's a lot of force, a lot of power, and a lot of active advancement of their agenda, almost more rapidly than we can parse right now. And that's just a reality.
I think we also need to look at some of these issues where you're talking about Trump supporters, where we have these clear lines of delineation that are connected to a specific political party. And there's this exclusiveness that's established within that. And one of the things that I've looked at recently is the psychological impacts on societies that exclude, that there are psychological impacts on the individuals who are responsible for excluding others that are as deep as the impacts of being excluded. It takes away people's autonomy. And it destroys their ability to really develop this sense of connection and belonging with others outside of their group. And so one of the things that I think we need to really start looking at and start talking about, rather than, you know, those Trump supporters, let's start talking about how individuals within positions of power really malign us against one another and steal our autonomy. They steal our ability for critical thinking. They take away our ability to be able to see the truth of the matter before us because we're blinded by our alliance to whatever party line or other type of social line that we've drawn for ourselves. And so that issue is a critical issue right now. We have to look at how do we move beyond those lines to start opening people's hearts and minds to the reality of what's going on the ground. Because the reality of what's going on the ground is that this country is not becoming great. This country is becoming a dumping ground for toxins. This country is becoming the playground of the oil and gas industry. Every single thing that Donald Trump has done has been to promote and support the oil and gas industry. Pruitt was just confirmed today, the day that we're recording the show, and his history with combat with the Environmental Protection Agency, and now he's heading it. He has fought against environmental protection for his whole career. Rex Tillerson, who is another oil and gas executive, that these people are being put into positions where they are being allowed to determine for all of us what the health of our country is going to be. And it's all being based on this idea of expanding an economy that is outdated. It's being done at the expense of the lives and the livelihoods of the people here. Majority of that product is going to be shipped outside of this country. What we're going to be left with is we're going to be left with cleaning up the mess for generations to come that these men are creating in our country. This has nothing to do with politics. This is all about greed and industry. And we need people to start waking up to the fact that they are blindly following and giving their allegiance to somebody who does not have their best interests at heart, who is not thinking about the future of their children, and who is selling their ability to survive on this land to the highest bidder. So we need to start looking at how do we have conversations with those people who are in positions that are opposed to us, whose mind really has been stolen by their allegiance to this exclusive club that they believe that they're a part of. They believe, hey, our side is winning. We don't care what the people who are representing us are doing to other human beings. We don't care what they're doing to the land. We don't care what happens to us in the future, so long as we're winning. This idea of winning at all costs is a mental illness. And we need to start addressing those issues within the population and start having conversations with people to just question those things. So explain to me how dumping coal runoff into our waters is going to make America great again. Explain that to me. How does contaminating the waterways for our current and future populations make us more safe and more secure in the future? How does stealing our ability to be able to survive make us stronger? Explain that to me. And just start having the conversations with people to ask them to reclaim their autonomy, to reclaim their ability to think logically and critically about these issues that we're facing, rather than getting into an us versus them competition, which is what a lot of the discussion has been. It's been those Trump supporters. Those are human beings that we need to engage, because we need to move them back to the side of life. Because right now, they're not standing on the side of life. They are standing on the side of death and destruction. And so how do we engage them and move them back toward life? That's one of the most critical questions that we need to answer right now.
I think it's one of the interesting parts of that equation is just the way we all think we're right. We all have this perspective that we know what is best, and regardless of whether or not our views on a particular part of that rightness or righteousness are completely diametrically opposed to the person that we're speaking with. And one of the things that I appreciate about what you just said is that the protection of our water and the protection of our land from chemical toxicity and the effects of environmental pollution should be a non-negotiable subject for all people. It really should. And, you know, we have privileges in this country that protect and shelter certain people from those effects. We know that most of the chemical toxicity sites in this country are placed on Native American and low-income neighborhoods, which tend to be where people of color also live. But we also know that there's a lot of people on both the left and the right who genuinely, and I don't mean like superficially, but I mean genuinely, have a devout love of the land, and that ranchers and rural farmers and that people who like to hunt and fish and people who also, you know, are vegetarian bird watchers, for example, all share this love of the land. And that when we think about the mythology, because it's always been a mythology, of what makes America great, one of the things that comes to people's minds is the beauty and the majesty of this land. And if we're going to really think about that as Americans, as those who are, for better or for worse, sharing this country right now and supposedly sharing the governance of it, although that is also mythological at the moment, this is literally, not just figuratively, but literally our common ground. And that I believe we can meet upon it and we can really discuss it. And we can really mobilize together. We all, left and right, who belong to what we might say, we the people, need to decide whether or not we want to be aligned with that agenda that's leading to the sickness of our children and all the world's children and the potential extermination of our entire species. And then to rally to this challenge of our times in a way that is commensurate with the danger that we are facing and its urgency and its immediacy. It's not impossible. It's challenging, but not impossible. And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID.
We know the sweet world is not going to end, 'cause it's always returning.
I think one of the ways that we do that is by taking responsibility for one another again. We're starting to see that happen where there are people who are willing to provide safe zones for refugee and immigrant populations who are at risk right now here in this country. Part of the problem that we have is we look at the system as one kind of structure that's got all this power. But one of the things that this system does is it takes away from us. It takes away our sense of responsibility for one another. And so we diminish our role as caretakers when we outsource that work to the government. And so our system of government has been designed to separate us from our responsibility toward one another in many ways, making us negligent in our efforts to ensure that our family, our friends, our neighbors are properly taken care of. Instead of taking in our hungry brothers and feeding them, we send them to social services. Instead of taking care of those with deep emotional and spiritual wounds, we send them to a stranger for talk therapy or medication. You know, we have all of these artificial systems that are designed to pick up the slack for us. And what that's done is it's actually diminished and weakened our sense of responsibility and our ability to care for one another in meaningful ways. And if we want to kind of reclaim our place within that sphere of creation of being caretakers of one another and caretakers of the earth, then I think that we need to take the power away from these systems and reclaim them for ourselves. It's much easier to want somebody else to do the work and to pay for it. And we can say, no, this illusory they need to fix this. They need to change their system. They need to do this and they need to do that. No, we need to take responsibility for one another. And one of the things that I see as being hopeful about this time is that people are doing that. They're taking power out of these systems by reclaiming their own sense of responsibility towards others. And so you have people that are stepping forward to protect one another, to shelter one another, to care for one another, to secure the protections and the resources that are necessary to support life for others. We're seeing that at Standing Rock, where people are standing with the people there to protect life, to protect our vital waterways. And, you know, that's the most critical work of our time, is protecting the water. I've said that many times on the show. And so you are having people starting to take back their responsibility towards one another and towards the earth. And I think that's a hopeful thing. I think that's a really good thing. I think we've become too dependent on these false structures and these false systems that are supposed to take all of our responsibility away from us in that regard. And that all they're doing is separating us from one another. They're creating these competition scenarios where people are competing for a limited amount of resources that are available, and they're forgetting that they are their brothers and sisters' keepers. And so as we go forward and start doing this work, dismantling these false hierarchies and these false power structures means taking our energy, taking our buy-in away, divesting in every possible way, and reinvesting in the type of things that create community, that create support networks that ensure that everybody has enough, that everybody is safe, that everybody is able to live with some type of dignity, that we are the ones that are responsible for doing that. And the way to engage this revolution of love is with love for one another and a deep commitment to start stepping up, showing up, and caring for one another in really meaningful and tangible ways. You know, there's a prayer vigil going on in Portland, Maine this weekend that's called Pray With Your Feet. That's from an African proverb. And the whole meaning behind that is that you don't just sit quietly and pray for things to change. You actually start moving your feet in the direction of change. And that action becomes your prayer. That's what we need to be doing right now. We need to be taking back responsibility for the care of one another, for the care of the earth. We need to stop giving all of our power away and then complaining that they're misusing the power that they've taken or that we've given them, and really start stepping up in ways that we never have before, which means we put down our devices, we get off the couch, we stop sitting in front of our screens and blogging about it, and actually get out there, and we feed people, and we clothe people, and we protect them. We make sure that they have adequate health care and that their medical needs are met. You know, we do all of the things that we wish this illusory other was going to do for us under this false system of power. And we reclaim our power as human beings and reclaim our relationships and our responsibilities towards one another.
I love that, Sherry. And what's ironically occurring to me as you speak is that that's actually what many conservatives, or those who would label themselves as conservatives, have articulated as well. And that, ironically, that is a common ground that we may meet upon. But I want to just extend the parameters of the challenge that you issue to really shake up and challenge some not so healthy interpretations of that. So oftentimes I see people doing exactly that work you just described, but within a very narrow scope of definition. So we do it for our family, we do it for our friends, we might do it through the auspices of our church. And there our range of caring stops. Or maybe we do it through our town, and there our range of caring stops. Now the challenge is really to realize that this was a very workable mentality when there were much fewer people on the planet and we were much more isolated and much more organized by almost genetic tribes of people. But we're 7.2 billion people and we impact the fate of the entire planet through our collective actions. And this kind of caring that you speak about, I know in your mind, Sherry, it extends as far as we can possibly extend it. And so I want to articulate that level of caring, make sure people really understand that it's not enough anymore to love our neighbor and feed the homeless once a week while we allow trade policies like NAFTA to impoverish Mexico, for example, which leads to immigrants coming to this country to try to actually earn the money to support their families and themselves. We need to care deeply at that level as well. We need to care as a global society because we are a global society. The things that we do in our own world, in our own lives, in our community, end up affecting everything. And so there are people in this country for whom privilege has become a sheltering umbrella in which they can outsource the effects or the costs of what has become their comfort and convenience. And they don't have to think about what's behind the labels, their familiar and comforting labels in the grocery store. That kind of behavior needs to stop. We need to know. We need to become versed. And so taking care of one another in our communities is important, and just as important is taking care of our global society. And that I completely agree with you, Sherry, that we try to outsource this behavior, both on the left and on the right, in various ways. We try to get our government to enact laws that make us all behave in a certain way. And one side of the equation hates that, and the other side of the equation promotes that. Or we try to take our government out of the equation and put it all on the shoulders of personal responsibility without weighing the differing levels of ease by which we can take personal responsibility. Not everyone can actually afford a Prius and a set of solar panels to charge that Prius. So the conversation is complex, but the invitation is to start engaging and keep going further, because this is the saving grace of our times. If we're going to have a next chapter of human existence, this is the page-turning moment, and the act of turning the page is engaging that personal responsibility, caring, awareness, compassion, and social, political, economic, and cultural transformation in the hopes that when we turn this page, we will actually have the rest of the story, not the end of the human species.
Well, you know, the end that we envision and the end that we work toward certainly does not involve the end of our species. However, we have to be willing to face the reality that that's the direction that we're heading in. And we have to take responsibility for that. I think it's interesting that one of the markers for dependent personality disorder is a feeling of helplessness and an inability to cope with the greater challenges of life, which results in a transference of our responsibility for the conditions of our lives and well-being onto another, which causes us to have all these persistent dependent leanings. And our government, our education, our employment, and certainly most religions train us to be obedient to power and dependent on some higher authority. And so, you know, as we're looking at some of those things, I think it's really important to look at that in a really broken down, fundamental way. One of the things that you talked about is that view is often kind of promoted by a lot of conservatives. There is a clear distinction between what I'm talking about and their position, because the conservative position is to cut off all support without any follow through, to, you know, just kind of, it's kind of like a survival of the fittest mentality, where all of the people at the top are deemed fittest because the deck was stacked in their favor and everyone else is left out. It's not about an equal distribution of wealth. It's not about an equal distribution of resources. It's not about ensuring that everyone is taken care of, that everyone has enough to thrive, to live their lives with dignity, and to then in turn offer whatever gifts they have back to society to make society stronger. It's all based on competitive models and hierarchies of power that actually cut off the ability of those who live within the lower rungs of this false caste system that we live under to fend for themselves while all of the resources are being hoarded at the top. So the idea of cutting off the support for those who are struggling while the deck is stacked in their favor, that's often espoused by the conservatives, is very different from what I'm talking about, as you had said. And we don't need to look much farther than to look at the pro-life conversations where, according to those individuals, life ends at birth. As long as you birth your child and don't abort it, you know, they're all about protecting that birth, but they're not about protecting and ensuring the survival and the well-being of the mother and child going forward into the future. They're not willing to take that responsibility. And that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about, is about really equalizing its redistribution of community wealth in a way that's more equal. It doesn't mean that people can't still make money. It doesn't mean that they still can't have nice things. It just means that they can't have so much that they deny others with the ability to survive. And, you know, the way that we restructure those systems is that we stop giving our money to those people. We start giving our resources to the ones that need it. We start developing community systems that are based on sharing economies. We start making sure that everyone within our circles is well taken care of. If everybody did that, you know, you said that, you know, most people don't look beyond their family or their communities. If everybody was taking care of their families and their communities and was putting their resources back into those areas, then the world would be a very different place. As it is right now, we're constantly complaining about those who have all of this power on all of this wealth and all these resources, yet we're the ones that are providing them with the opportunity to have that by giving them our money, by giving them our time. And so we need to take responsibility for how we invest our lives as well. How do we invest our money? How do we invest our time? How do we invest ourselves in building the type of world that we want to live in? It's not utopian. There are very practical things that you can do on the ground to be able to make that a reality. And those are the types of things that I think need to spin out of this time. And, you know, we could spend a whole month of shows talking about these things and still barely scratch the surface. But certainly looking at making sure that everyone has enough food, developing some sort of food sovereignty program in your community where you're not dependent on big industrial food programs, that you are creating the capacity to be able to feed the people within your community locally. Some type of energy sovereignty where you're not feeding your money into these big systems that are destroying our planet, the fossil fuel industry? How do we create educational sovereignty so that we can educate our children to be creative, critical thinkers instead of being obedient to an addicted to society? And so how do we change all of those things? We change them in very, very simple ways by localizing everything. I'm going to say that over and over and over again. We localize everything and we take away all of the power that we've given away to these systems. And we can do that. You know, we can do that. And so, and we can do that while we're also holding back the flood of harm that is coming our way as a result of the centuries of power that we have given away. And so it's really about responsibility. It's about taking responsibility for the state of the world, realizing that we've all been complicit in arriving in this place, and then taking active steps to shift our collective direction as one in a unified way.
One of the things that comes to mind about that is the Walton family, an enormously wealthy family that is actually the wealthiest family in the world, but doesn't pay their workers living wages. So actually our government is subsidizing the wealth of the Walton family, which means, in effect, that we are subsidizing in so many ways the wealth of the Walton family. Why are we doing this? Now, on the other end of the spectrum, a lot of us are still shopping at Walmarts, and I get it. I understand that most of us are now living in economic conditions that to go local all at once, cold turkey, can be extremely difficult, if not impossible. But we all can take $5 a week. Not all of us. Most of us can take $5 a week from the Walton family and put it back into a family near us, whether it's here in my town, we have people from local farms who are selling potatoes on the side of the road, or beans, or Chico corn, or whatever it may be. If I can take that $5 and give it to them instead of the Waltons, that is dispersing the wealth, that is reinvesting in local community. And wherever we can, in large and small ways, we do need to be doing this work. Like we've been saying on this whole show, it's really a time of taking personal responsibility and getting into that uncomfortable and sometimes exhilarating process of change on every single level of our lives, as if our lives depended on it, because they do. They really do. And that for me, you know, one of the odd and exciting things about these times is that these are not the usual times most of us have grown up in, of a sort of negative peacetime. So Dr. King articulated this concept around negative peace. We think of peace as a very pleasant and calm and beautiful looking neighborhood, everything's okay. But a negative peace is when you know that injustice, racism, economic inequality underlies that outwardly seeming peacefulness and calmness. Right, so that's a negative peace. We've been living in that negative peace for hundreds and thousands of years, with episodes and time periods for varying groups, depending on where you fall on what you said, the faux caste system or the hidden caste system within the United States and globally. Sometimes it's not so hidden. We have experienced times that are not peaceful whatsoever. But now we are actually more and more of us are being propelled into a time that really isn't about peace. It's about struggle. It's about change. It's about transformation. It's about routing out the injustices that have persisted. And for me, that's what this time is all about.
One of the things that I've been talking to people about, which has been really interesting, and I think that we'll probably do a show on this coming up in the near future, is how do you remain peaceful? How do you maintain your nonviolent stance when there are so many mounting attacks on life? One of the things that my friend Paul talks about is that there's only one excuse for avoiding nonviolence, and that's an immediate threat to your life. Like if you're trying to save your life. And so there have been a lot of people that have been approaching me and saying, okay, we have an immediate threat to our life. At which point do we abandon nonviolence and start taking things into our own hands? And trying to talk through those issues and help people to understand that, you know, you can't dismantle the master's house with the master's tools kind of arguments, that we cannot continue to perpetuate these cycles of violence and expect to have a more peaceful outcome on the other side. So one of the things that we'll be talking about coming up, which you all may want to tune into, is how do we maintain our nonviolent stance in the face of an immediate threat to life? Not a long-term rights issue, but an immediate threat to life, which is what we're facing right now with the destruction of our environment that is rapidly accelerating. So, you know, we need to be looking at those issues and talking about very practical ways for us to be engaging that process on the ground right now, because there is an immediate threat to life that is being posed. And it's not just for those people who are on the front line. It's not just generations of children who have been brain damaged in Flint. It's not just generations of children who are dying from rare and aggressive forms of cancer as a result of fossil fuel contamination. It's not just the families of those individuals who are blown up by gas line explosions. It's all of us. This is one living system that is inextricably connected, and that we cannot separate ourselves from the harms that are occurring, because there's a finite amount of water on our planet. And we are rapidly reaching, if not exceeding, the tipping point where we're no longer going to be able to prevent the bulk of harm that's coming, but we may be able to stop it from obliterating our entire species. And the way that we do that is by recognizing that our species does not have dominion over the natural world, that we do not have dominion over the earth, that we are just one piece of this living system. And we have to take responsibility for our obligations to life. One of the things that one of my elders told me is that, you know, the native people have been speaking for the earth ever since the relationship began with the newcomers. And we don't speak for the earth because we're stewards of the earth or keepers of the earth. We're, in fact, only keepers of a way of life that's in harmony with the earth. So our responsibility is to keep that way of life, what we here in Wabanaki territory call Skijinawe Bamoswagin, living that indigenous way of life close to the earth. The reason that we speak on behalf of the earth is because we are able to speak the language that other human beings understand. And when we look around, we see that human beings are the only species that have fallen out of step with the rest of creation. And we are the only species that is posing a threat to the life of all living beings on this planet. And therefore, it's our responsibility to speak on behalf of the entire world, on behalf of the beings in the natural world, on behalf of the plants and the trees and the waters, that, you know, we hold that responsibility as human beings, as part of a species that is wreaking havoc and destruction on the earth. And so how do we maintain that stance? How do we maintain enough of a strength in our posture to be able to protect the continuation of life? That's going to be a topic of conversation that I think is going to come up, because these things are spiraling out quickly and they're going to come to a head quickly. And so maybe on our next show, maybe the show after that, we'll be talking about how do we address immediate threats to life from a position of nonviolence.
Well, that will be an amazing conversation. It will definitely be a conversation for a future show, since we are running out of time. This always happens to us. We get really excited. We're always excited from minute one to minute 59 of the show. But one of the things that comes to mind that we also have to challenge is around our belief that violence will get us what we want. That violence is the most effective and fastest solution to the problem. There's some situations where that's valid, and there's a lot of situations where that's not. And we need to be savvy about that. Really deeply savvy right now, because the choices we make are going to matter deeply. So more to talk about on the next show. On this show, I want to say, Sherry Mitchell, it's always an honor and a pleasure to join you on Love and Revolution Radio for these reflection and review shows. I think they're some of the most important work we do on the airwaves in the course of putting out these shows week after week.
And I agree. It's always an honor and a pleasure. It's stimulating and enlightening for us to have these conversations with one another and with all of our listeners. And I just want to leave us today with a quote from Tatanka Yutake, also known as Sitting Bull, who was the great Lakota warrior who was involved in one of the most notorious battles in history, the fight at Greasy Grass Creek, which is also known as the Battle of Little Bighorn. And when Sitting Bull was asked about what a warrior is, this is what he said. Warriors are not what you think of as warriors. The warrior is not someone who fights because no one has the right to take another life. The warrior for us is one who sacrifices himself for the good of others. His task is to take care of the elderly, the defenseless, those who cannot provide for themselves, and above all, the children, the future of humanity. So as we start thinking about these discussions going forward, it's going to be our responsibility to remember that the true charge of a warrior is to serve and protect life. It is never to take life. And so it's important for us to reinstitute those values into the work that we do going forward and not continue to perpetuate the values of conquest. Until next time, thank you very much for joining us on Love and Revolution Radio. Thanks this week to my co-host, Rivera Sun. It is always inspiring and thought-provoking to share the airwaves with you, and today has been no exception. I think we've begun a conversation that is going to last us for years into the future, and I look forward to expanding on that conversation and deepening our understanding of our role within this time. Our theme song, Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson, is performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And thank you to you, Sherry, for this conversation. I think it's going to take us a few lifetimes, actually, to get through this one. If you enjoyed what Sherry was saying on this show, you might also enjoy her Sacred Instructions Facebook page, the link to which can be found on the Love and Revolution page and on the podcast notes. We also have a new Love and Revolution Radio Facebook page, so go find it and check it out and give us a like, because you know what? We're kind of likable. This is a weekly radio program, and many local radio stations broadcast it over their airwaves. Oftentimes, the station managers are very happy to fit it into their schedule if a local listener like you calls them up and asks them. We can be reached through the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Sherry Mitchell. What we need in the world at this time is a core group of warriors who are willing to stand up for the long haul to serve and protect life. Not only do we have to be those warriors, we also have to take responsibility for cultivating the warriors of tomorrow. To do that, we have to be willing to take responsibility for nourishing the ground where they will grow. We have to get down on that ground and plant the seeds that will allow them to develop. Then we have to ensure that their environment is capable of providing them with everything that they need, including a set of core cultural values that honors the sacredness of every life. Maybe you'll take some time to think about how you can begin cultivating the ground to support the next generation of warriors in your community by the time we talk to you next week.